lastly pass you on to my dear colleague Deirdre Johnson from Asia.
Thank you. Okay, I too would like to just bring a little bit of my. Okay.
Press the button in the middle. Get the light on.
Which button?
Did I just push
something? Yeah, there you go.
You push something.
Right. Yeah. Now, can you hear me clearly?
Yeah. So I too would just like to bring a little bit of my own story into this. And again, from my early days, well, before I did any training, was just sort of interested in the ideas and the reading and sampling things. First was reading a book, which might have been The Fundamentals of Co-Counseling. So for those of you who might not know co-counseling, it's a peer-centered, reciprocal counseling endeavor. What really struck me, you have to think of me as very based in classical reading, full of the kind of, well, just a lot of literature from the classics of all kinds. And in this book, the first chapter was unremarkable in one particular way, but the second chapter struck me, I can't tell you how it resonated. Suddenly all the he's, him's, his's were changed into she's and hers. So the first chapter was using all the male pronouns for the general, and the second chapter switched to the female. I probably before that would have argued, oh, it's just language. I was in my early 20s. I would have argued this is that the he's and the him's do count both ways. But I had an absolutely shocking experience that it didn't. When I read that second chapter for the first time, a book that was talking about people and ideas was actually speaking to me. The she's and the hers felt personal in a way I hadn't realized all these he's and him's just never had. I didn't know it until I had that experience. That was one thing. The other was a very simple sentence, and I can't remember what book it was in, which was just to comment that probably it's true for most human beings that we haven't reached a fraction of our full potential. So that sort of excited me. And those, in a way, are good key thoughts for my theme today, because one being around the potential of the human being, and the other to do with issues, minorities, diversity, power. And I want to take these two themes to look at both what is extremely valuable in Jungian analysis and aspects of humanistic psychology, and also what can be so dangerous. So both valuable and dangerous. Both Jungian analysis. Oh, I'm going to talk specifically from about psychosynthesis, which was my... I have two trainings. They both talk about the self, or the higher self, as transcending the ego. And in Jung, the idea of the self as a whole can be rediscovered through the synthesis of various aspects of the personality. It might be persona and shadow, or personal and collective, and the ego and the contrasexual opposite. And it's this last one I want to look at. So the internal figure of the opposite sex. Jung describes how we can come to the formation of that imago through, first of all the influence of the people of the opposite sex, parents, teachers, and so on. And secondly, that imago can be formed of what we deny in ourselves as belonging only to the opposite sex, so what we disavow. Also, there will be those aspects of the opposite sex that we haven't yet developed. These first three are personal, and then, of course, there are archetypal aspects of this imago. And it's this last one that gets us into trouble, where we get the problems. at the core of this contrasexual complex, according to Jung, is the archetype of the animus and the anima, his terms. Now, as you may well be aware, Jung defines the archetypes generally as tendencies in the psyche to create images or symbols along certain prototypical lines, and therefore they don't have any content. It's a tendency and it doesn't contain any content. There's no shopping list. But at other times in his thinking, he does actually go on to describe certain traits within the archetype, and it's this contradiction that can create problems. And contemporary Jungians have critiqued this inconsistency of thought. Unfortunately, I can't go too deeply into that, because there's also the issue of how it's a very heterosexually orientated theory. I have to leave that to another time. But Jung, just to use his descriptions, his of the negative anima in the man, he described as fickle, capricious, moody, uncontrolled, and emotional, and the negative animus in the woman as obstinate, harping on principles, laying down the law, dogmatic, world-reforming, theoretic, word-mongering, argumentative, and domineering. Just to note, you may have already noted, there's more than twice as many negatives to the animus as to the in the woman as the Now, interestingly, I think Jung began with observations, obviously within a context in his in time and place. And I think his first, he talks about his first idea was that men would be thinking types and women are feeling types, and you can see his ideas of thinking and feeling here. He does actually admit, however, that he changed his mind on that and realised that there were women who were thinking types and men who were feeling types, but he didn't seem to come back and revise his theory of his gender theory on that basis. So just leaving Jung for a moment there and looking at Assad Joly, who also talks about, so in psychosynthesis, also talks about the masculine and feminine. In his paper, The Balance and Synthesis of the Opposites, he takes really as his hypothesis that polarity is inherent throughout the universe. However, he does claim this as a universal fact, and of course we can't know for certain whether the polarities are objectively observable or a projection of our own polarizing tendencies as human beings. But leaving that aside, he says in the area of physical polarity, he describes polarity in terms of a metaphor of the negative and positive charges of the particle in an atom. And he goes on to look at sexuality in plants, animals, and humans. But here he uses the metaphor as if it were a fact. He writes, "The positive pole is represented by the masculine element and the negative by the feminine element. This does not mean that the former is active and the latter passive." That's like Freud's active-passive polarity. "Both are active, but in a different way. The masculine element being the dynamic initiating pole, while the feminine element is the receptive, gestative, elaborative pole." A mouthful. "This type of polarity extends far beyond the man-woman relationship," so clearly including it, "to innumerable manifestations in life." But in using the metaphor of positively charged particles of electricity, which of course is only a theory in science, a hypothesis effectively, he, presumably unconsciously, slips in a sleight of hand. It's these sleights of hands that I want to focus on. It's very common, I think, in both the psychosynthesis and Jungian thinking. There's a hidden move from biological observation of behaviours to an idea of an essential masculine or feminine trait in the psyche of the human being. That's been termed biological determinism. But there's a second move from observed particulars of certain categories of people at certain time and in a certain place to a generalization that can creep in to speaking about all such categories of people in all places and in all times. Susan Rowland has criticized this rightly with a feminist revision, calling it essentialism. So, Assad Joly had a gendered polarity with masculine equaling dynamic and feminine equaling receptive. For Jung, it was logos and eros. For Freud, active, passive. And interesting for Winnicott, who writes, it was being, doing. And for some post-Jungians, they talk about diffused functioning versus focused functioning. But given these claims are about universal difference and therefore supposed to be applicable to all sexes at all times and in all places, I find it remarkable how very varied these universal truths are. So why are we thinking of them as dangerous? Well, the problem with that form of essentialist thinking is that when you, by talking in terms of universals, it turns what is descriptive into what is prescriptive. So we could just take an example of 21st century UK. More women tend to be drawn to the caring professions than men. Now, we could simply note this as a sociological fact. But of course, if we deduce from that that all women always and everywhere are better at the caring professions than all men, we're into the false assumption. And I think we should make no bones about this, really, because when we talk about the feminine or the feminine principle, with a capital F, or the masculine and the masculine principle, and, you know, can wax quite poetic about gendered polarities, such as active and passive, I think we are in a great danger of doing that. Briefly, I think there is an important place for description of present differences. One example might be female MPs in the UK have agitated about the later hours of parliamentary meetings, which can discriminate against them if they've got childcare. But of course, that's very... And noticing that difference as a present, important, significant difference is important. But of course, that's very different from the sort of prescriptive thinking which could suggest that women shouldn't be going for such jobs in the first place. So I think the studies which note the way in which gender roles are different is valuable, but the psychological theorising which prescribes those roles becomes dangerous. I'd like to just briefly take up distinctions between sex and gender that have been made. Of course, there's many more recent advances in social and religious anthropology since both Jung's and Assagioli's lifetimes. And these have shown that certain traits that might be deemed masculine in one group and feminine in another group can actually vary across cultures. One little example is in the Inuits, sewing is completely masculine occupation. It's deemed as valuable. Women can't touch it, which, you know, big contrast. Big contrast. Writers such as Ethel Spector Pearson, Susan Rowland, Andrew Samuels, Polly Young Eisendrath, have all used this distinction between sex and gender to clarify this thinking. And generally, sex will be defined more as a matter of embodiment, of structural and functional properties of the human body, and gender more as a construct from both within and without the individual, both on their own account and by the culture in which they find themselves. We could ask, is gender entirely construct? Those from the transgender community question this. A definition I think is very nuanced and helpful is Susan McKenzie's, who defines gender as an emergent category of mind, so emergent where the whole is greater than the sum of the parts, an emergent category of mind involving a coming together of biological, cultural, relational, neuropsychological and developmental factors. And there may, of course, be others we don't know of. But here's a, as I say, complex, nuanced definition which allows for a complex of different factors. Polly Young Eisendrath notes that all societies have only two gender clubs. So gender creates both a division among human beings and division within the psyche between what is called the self and what is regarded as its opposite. What's left out of our self-identified gender is considered to be other. So Young Eisendrath talks about the Cora archetype as that of the other, the non-self. One of the things I found a lot in the work and experience of intense falling in love is how pivotal this experience can be for people in terms of an introduction, or not introduction, but touching on something that we might term the transcendent. So falling in love really can be this opening to the transcendent. And here, the encounter with the other is potentially hugely transformative. This other, I suggest, though, is particularly an erotic other. It's particularly sexually and emotionally charged with attraction. The figure of the inner lover or beloved or the soulmate, one's lost other half, may haunt us in our longings and drive us to both wonderful and terrible extremes. And I think Jung's exploration of what is taking place here is hugely helpful, both for a person's spiritual development and for their outer love relationships. But just a brief note, that erotic other doesn't necessarily coincide with a contrasexual other. This is only true for heterosexuals. Back to our two gender clubs. I like to imagine two boxes. I'm going to do that awful convention and ask you to imagine a blue one marked for boys and men and a pink one marked for girls and women. The definition of traits as being masculine or feminine, of course, suggests two mutually exclusive categories. So if we take a trait such as courage, then we, in a sense, have to choose which box we put it in if we're going to label in that way. And a man or a boy who seems fearful then gets the term, gets called pussy, which of course is the insult based on the female genitals as an insult. So at least in terms of our less conscious assumptions, what we put in the male box can't be put in the female one and vice versa. You can see that in this game one cannot really have a trait considered as masculine in the feminine box or the other way around, nor indeed, that's most important, can one trait such as courage be in both boxes. So you can't have masculine courage and feminine courage. It tends to be an either or. But I want to argue that if we look at the tendency to gender polarization as a projection of the human psyche, then the idea of the balance and synthesis of opposites becomes something potentially very fruitful. Then we can see our boxes perhaps as containing traits that we, both male and female, that we tend to polarize with a label of being masculine. What happens if we refuse to be forced into this mutual exclusivity? What if we can belong to both clubs? What if we challenge even the color of the boxes themselves? Mm-hmm. Then something very exciting happens. If we argue that versatility is greater, the greater freedom there is, that allows us to fulfill our human potential. We can think perhaps of gender integration or gender role integration as a way of developing more of that versatility. I just want to go to the conclusion here. I have to leave a little bit out. Jungian psychology and humanistic psychology share an idea of the human being as having a spiritual or transcendent function. But spirituality often focuses on the bird's eye view as opposed to the on the ground. And I think it's worth just thinking about the fact that if we focus on the bird's eye view, we might have more of a tendency to universalizing. That could be our particular shadow. So I just want to emphasize that in dealing with reality or the transcendent, we probably want to look at both oneness and multiplicity. And poetically put, reality manifests as both oneness and diversity, both as what we share with others and also what we share uniquely.
We've got 10 minutes for questions.
Phil Goss, I'm a Jungian analyst. I've much enjoyed what we have to say, Deirdre. The thing that I wrestle with is in my analytic work and in thinking about gender is where the dangers come in, which you've described, where sex, gender and role all get conflated together so that universal prescriptions are applied to how we read gender roles. I completely go with that. What in my experience, though, that there are differences that are experiential between sometimes between male experience and female experience, and there's something in that about instinct. There's something in that about sex. There's something in that about life stages. So, for example, the way that men respond to childbirth, I think, broadly speaking, isn't quite the same as the way that women do. So around that, and in my analytic practice, I've noticed that the kind of suffering that can come through that is distinctive between men and women. So I just wondered what your thoughts were on that, really. And then the other bit is from a Jungian perspective, I have a teaching role as well as an analytic one. And with my the humanistic colleagues I work with, I've never quite got a sense of what their take on gender difference or the deeper psychology of gender is. So I'd be really interested to hear anything that anybody has to say about that.
Okay, well, if I take up the first one, absolutely. And this is one of the reasons why I find Susan McKenzie's definition of gender so helpful, because if you remember, it talks about the biological, conditioned, cultural, neuropsychological, and so on. So clearly, being embodied as a woman is going to give me a different experience. That's one element of my gender identity. But there are others as well. Now, those aspects could quarrel, and I think an experience of transgender is when there's some experience of dissonance between my embodied identity and my gender role identity, if you like. So I think it is very important that we do include the embodied experience. I hope that meets... Yeah. As to the other, I think that can be... Hopefully we can discuss...
Bill Goss has a book on gender, as you do. We have a bookstore today.
We are supposed to, actually. I haven't seen them.
No, I haven't seen
them. Or maybe they're coming in the break, Carnax. Yeah. Yeah. Anybody else? Can't hear you. I'm not sure it's on.
We'll go very close. Very, very close.
Is that
on? Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure what I want to say because I've got a very mixed background. I'm more eclectic than any particular orientation.
Closer.
Yeah, okay. So, yeah, I was a psychology lecturer, then trained in therapy, but very generally. I have great admiration for Jung. I think maybe, you know, reflecting on the composition of people here, it seems to be fairly even male and female, and that's what he emphasised. One thing he doesn't seem to emphasise is about race. You know, and I notice we are nearly exclusively white here. And the reason I say that is because I also taught sociology in my graduate career. And I found one thing that psychology didn't cover that sociology did was a much more wide perspective about human nature. You know, when I taught psychology, I found there was this danger of focusing on the individual and not looking around the world the way it really is. And I'm not accusing Jung of not doing that, because I know he did travel around the world. But then, I may be wrong, I think he was accused of being a bit gracious. You know, he did focus on what white people would think rather than what the people around the world think about male and female roles. And a lot of it, what we're talking about now, I think is very much white oriented. Not very much gender. You know, as I said, if I know what I want to say,
Well, thank you. I think that's really important, and in a way what I've critiqued here with gender is exactly the same sort of problem of universalizing. So if you start to define races, particularly from outside of that group, you get exactly that danger, which is the basis of racism or stereotyping. So again, it's Jung's value is in looking at these issues, differences between men and women or races, but the danger is when he started to detail these differences.
Could I say something?
Go ahead.
I just wanted to say that recently I did a seminar with Sonu Chandrasani on an original Jung document, and one of my favourite documents was a letter from Carrie Baines, who was part of the Jung circle, on this issue of gender, the psychology of gender. And she said to Jung, if you want to know about women's psychology, instead of all this mythologizing and theorizing, why don't you go down to Zurich High Street and talk to some real women?
Some nice stories.
Any more? I think we've got time for maybe two short ones.
Yeah. Annette Elliott, Jungian analyst. Could I pick up what Phil Goss said? Could I know what the humanistic take is on what we've just heard?
Well, I don't want to speak for all of them. I was trained in psychosynthesis first, and I do remember a very similar thing around the feminine with a capital F, the masculine. Very, very, you know, quite strongly. Now, I'm sure, you know, in terms of, like, with post-Jungians, there's been a post-Assad-Jungian critique of that, but it's in the literature, and I think we buy into it unconsciously, and so that's what I'm kind of wanting to alert to.
Yeah. And was there another? Yes, okay.
I'm Laura Fulcher, I'm an integrative child and adolescent psychotherapist. I think you said something about all societies have a binary for masculine and feminine, but actually a lot of societies have something in the middle as well. You know, if you look at ladyboys in Thailand, India, Native Americans, Romania, lots of places, so you didn't really mention that. I'm sure you know about it.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, at that point I was quoting Polly Young Eisengrath's idea of the gender clubs, but it is a very important aspect. And even in terms of sex, there's intersex. Even biology is not as clear as we tend to project onto it. So I think there's very important points. Thank you.
Okay. Should we just take 1 minute to have a breathe before we move on to the next one? Because so that we don't get too overstuffed. I just meant a 1 minute break, literally. Okay. Can we come back now? Okay. Yeah. Madeline. Yeah. We're going to reassemble now. Yeah. I'm sorry. Hello. Can we come back? Thank you. how not to do it.
Okay. Can everybody sit back down now, please? Okay, I'm going to introduce our next speaker. If I could just have your attention, please. Oh, fantastic. Great, great. The bookstall's arrived, so in the break, when we get to it, we can all rampage Carnax.
I've just turned the heating down a bit as well.
Oh, great, great.
Hopefully it'll cool a bit.